This is disc number 4.
The camera caught, tantalizingly blurred by distance, a glimpse of something very strange. Many miles away, the golden landscape reared itself into a curiously symmetrical cone, like a volcanic mountain. Around the summit of that cone was a halo of small, puffy clouds, all about the same size, all quite distinct and isolated. There was something disturbing and unnatural about them, if indeed the word natural could ever be applied to this awesome panorama. Then, caught by some turbulence in the rapidly thickening atmosphere, the probe twisted around to another quarter of the horizon, and for a few seconds the screen showed nothing but a golden blur. Presently it stabilized. The sea was much closer, but as enigmatic as ever. One could now observe that it was interrupted here and there with patches of darkness, which might have been holes or gaps leading to still deeper layers of the atmosphere. The probe was destined never to reach them. Every mile, the density of the gas around it had been doubling, the pressure mounting as it sank deeper and deeper toward the hidden surface of the planet. It was still high above that mysterious sea when the picture gave one premonitory flicker, then vanished, as the first explorer from Earth crumpled beneath the weight of the miles of atmosphere above it. It had given, in its brief life, a glimpse of perhaps 1/1,000,000th of Jupiter, and had barely approached the planet's surface hundreds of miles down in the deepening mists. When the picture faded from the screen, Bowman and Poole could only sit in silence, turning the same thought over in their minds. The ancients had indeed done better than they knew when they named this world after the Lord of all the gods. If there was life down there, how long would it take even to locate it? And after that, how many centuries before men could follow this first pioneer? In what kind of ship? But these matters were now no concern of Discovery and her crew. Their goal was a still stranger world, almost twice as far from the sun, across another 500,000,000 miles of comet-haunted emptiness. Part 4. Abyss. Chapter 21. Birthday Party. The familiar strains of Happy Birthday hurled across 700,000,000 miles of space at the velocity of light died away among the vision screens and instrumentation of the control desk. The Poole family, grouped rather self-consciously round the birthday cake on Earth, lapsed into a sudden silence. Then Mr. Poole Sr. said gruffly,
"Well, Frank, I can't think of anything else to say at the moment, except that our thoughts are with you, and we're wishing you the happiest of birthdays."
"Take care, darling," Mrs. Poole interjected tearfully. "God bless you."
There was a chorus of goodbyes, and the vision screen went blank. How strange to think, Poole told himself, that all this had happened more than an hour ago. By now, his family would have dispersed again, and its members would be miles from home. But in a way, that time lag, though it could be frustrating, was also a blessing in disguise. Like every man of his age, Poole took it for granted that he could talk instantly to anyone on Earth whenever he pleased. Now that this was no longer true, the psychological impact was profound. He had moved into a new dimension of remoteness, and almost all emotional links had been stretched beyond the yield point.
"Sorry to interrupt the festivities," said Hal, "but we have a problem."
"What is it?" Bowman and Poole asked simultaneously.
"I am having difficulty in maintaining contact with Earth. The trouble is in the AE-35 unit. My fault prediction center reports that it may fail within 72 hours.
"We'll take care of it," Bowman replied. "Let's see the optical alignment."
"Here it is, Dave. It's still okay at the moment."
On the display screen appeared a perfect half-moon, very brilliant against a background almost free of stars. It was covered with clouds and showed not one geographical feature that could be recognized. Indeed, at first glance, it could be easily mistaken for Venus. But not at a second one, for there beside it was the real moon, which Venus did not possess, a quarter the size of Earth and in exactly the same phase. It was easy to imagine that the two bodies were mother and child, as many astronomers had believed, before the evidence of the lunar rocks had proved beyond doubt that the moon had never been part of Earth. Poole and Bowman studied the screen in silence for half a minute. This image was coming to them from the long-focus TV camera mounted on the rim of the big radio dish. The cross wires at its center showed the exact orientation of the antenna. Unless the narrow pencil beam was pointed precisely at Earth, they could neither receive nor transmit. Messages in both directions would miss their target and would shoot, unheard and unseen, out through the solar system and into the emptiness beyond. If they were ever received, it would not be for centuries, and not by men.
"Do you know where the trouble is?" asked Bowman.
"It's intermittent, and I can't localize it, but it appears to be in the AE-35 unit."
"What procedure do you suggest?"
"The best thing would be to replace the unit with a spare, so that we can check it over."
"Okay, let us have the hard copy."
The information flashed on the display screen. Simultaneously, a sheet of paper slid out of the slot immediately beneath it. Despite all the electronic readouts, there are times when good old-fashioned printed material was the most convenient form of record. Bowman studied the diagrams for a moment, then whistled.
"You might have told us. This means going outside the ship."
"I'm sorry. I assumed you knew that the AE-35 unit was on the antenna mounting."
"I probably did a year ago. But there are 8,000 subsystems aboard. Anyway, it looks like a straightforward job. We only have to unlock a panel and put in a new unit." "That suits me fine," said Poole, who was the crew member designated for routine extravehicular activity. "I could do with a change of scenery. Nothing personal, of course." "Let's see if Mission Control agrees," said Bowman. He sat still for a few seconds, marshaling his thoughts, then started to dictate a message.
"Mission Control, this is X-ray Delta 1. At 2045, onboard fault prediction center in our Niner 000 computer showed Alpha Echo 35 unit as probable failure within 72 hours. Request check your telemetry monitoring and suggest you review unit in your ship systems simulator. Also, confirm your approval our plan to go EVA and replace Alpha Echo 35 unit prior to failure. Mission Control, this is X-ray Delta 12103, transmission concluded."
Through years of practice, Bowman could switch at a moment's notice to this jargon, which someone had once christened Technish, and back again to normal speech without clashing his mental gears. Now there was nothing to do but to wait for the confirmation, which would take at least 2 hours as the signals made the round trip past the orbits of Jupiter and Mars. It came while Bowman was trying, without much success, to beat Hal at one of the geometrical pattern games stored in his memory.
"X-ray Delta 1, this is Mission Control acknowledging your 2103. We are reviewing telemetric information on your mission simulator and will advise. Roger, your plan to go EVA and replace Alpha Echo 35 unit prior to possible failure. We are working on test procedures for you to apply to faulty unit."
The serious business having been completed, the mission controller reverted to normal English.
"Sorry you fellows are having a bit of trouble, and we don't want to add to your woes, but if it's convenient to you prior to EVA, we have a request from public information. Could you do a brief recording for general release, outlining the situation and explaining just what the AE-35 does? Make it as reassuring as you can. We could do it, of course, but it will be much more convincing in your words. Hope this won't interfere too badly with your social life. X-ray Delta 1, this is Mission Control 2155, transmission concluded."
Bowman could not help smiling at the request. There were times when Earth showed a curious insensitivity and lack of tact. Make it reassuring, indeed. When Poole joined him at the end of his sleep period, they spent 10 minutes composing and polishing the reply. In the early stages of the mission, there had been countless requests from all the news media for interviews, discussions, almost anything that they cared to say. But as the weeks drifted uneventfully past, and the time lag increased from a few minutes to over an hour, interest had gradually slackened. Since the excitement of the Jupiter flyby over a month ago, they had made only 3 or 4 tapes for general release.
"Mission Control, this is X-ray Delta 1.
Here's your press statement. Earlier today, a minor technical problem occurred. Our HAL 9000 computer predicted the failure of the AE-35 unit. This is a small but vital component of the communication system. It keeps our main antenna aimed at Earth to within a few thousandths of a degree. This accuracy is required, since at our present distance of more than 700 million miles, Earth is only a rather faint star, and our very narrow radio beam could easily miss it. The antenna is kept constantly tracking Earth by motors controlled from the central computer, but those motors get their instructions via the AE-35 unit. You might compare it to a nerve center in the body, which translates the brain's instructions to the muscles of a limb. If the nerve fails to pass on the correct signals, the limb becomes useless. In our case, a breakdown of the AE-35 unit could mean that the antenna will start pointing at random. This was a common trouble with the deep space probes of the last century. They often reached other planets, then failed to send back any information because their antenna couldn't locate Earth. We don't know the nature of the fault yet, but the situation is not at all serious and there is no need for alarm. We have two backup AE-35s, each of which has an operational life expectancy of 20 years, so the chance that a second will fail during the course of this mission is negligible. Also, if we can diagnose the present trouble, we may be able to repair the number one unit. Frank Poole, who is specially qualified for this type of work, will go outside the ship and replace the faulty unit with the backup. At the same time, he'll take the opportunity of checking the hull and repairing some micropunctures that have been too small to merit a special EVA. Apart from this minor problem, the mission is still going uneventfully and should continue in the same manner. Mission Control, this is X-ray Delta 12104, transmission concluded. Chapter 22, Excursion. Discovery's extravehicular capsules, or space pods, were spheres about 9 feet in diameter, and the operator sat behind a bay window which gave him a splendid view. The main rocket drive produced an acceleration of 1/5 of a gravity, just sufficient to hover on the moon, while small attitude control nozzles allowed for steering. From an area immediately beneath the bay window sprouted two sets of articulated metal arms, or Waldos, one for heavy duty, the other for delicate manipulation. There was also an extensible turret carrying a variety of power tools, such as screwdrivers, jackhammers, saws, and drills. Space pods were not the most elegant means of transport devised by man, but they were absolutely essential for construction and maintenance work in vacuum. They were usually christened with feminine names, perhaps in recognition of the fact that their personalities were sometimes slightly unpredictable. Discovery's trio were Anna, Betty, and Clara. Once he had put on his personal pressure suit, his last line of defense, and climbed inside the pod, Poole spent 10 minutes carefully checking the controls. He burped the steering jets, flexed the Waldos, reconfirmed oxygen, fuel, power reserve. Then, when he was completely satisfied, he spoke to Hal over the radio circuit. Though Bowman was standing by on the control deck, he would not interfere unless there was some obvious mistake or malfunction.
This is Betty. Start pumping sequence.
Pumping sequence started,
repeated Hal. At once, Poole could hear the throbbing of the pumps as precious air was sucked out of the lock chamber. Presently, the thin metal of the pod's external shell made crinkling, crackling noises. Then, after about 5 minutes, Hal reported,
"Pumping sequence concluded."
Poole made a final check of his tiny instrument panel. Everything was perfectly normal.
"Open outer door," he ordered.
Again, Hal repeated his instructions. At any stage, Poole had only to call hold, and the computer would stop the sequence immediately. Ahead, the walls of the ship slid apart. Poole felt the pod rock briefly as the last thin traces of air rushed into space. Then he was looking out at the stars, and, as it happened, at the tiny golden disk of Saturn, still 400 million miles away.
"Commence pod ejection."
Very slowly, the rail from which the pod was hanging extended itself out through the open door until the vehicle was suspended just beyond the hull of the ship. Poole gave a half-second burst on the main jet, and the pod slid gently off the rail, becoming at last an independent vehicle pursuing its own orbit around the sun. He now had no connection with Discovery, not even a safety line. The pods seldom gave trouble, and even if he got stranded, Bowman could easily come and rescue him. Betty responded smoothly to the control. He let her drift outward for 100 feet, then checked her forward momentum and spun her around so that he was looking back at the ship. Then he began his tour of the pressure hull. His first target was a fused area about 1/2 inch across, with a tiny central crater. The particle of dust that had impacted here at over 100,000 miles an hour was certainly smaller than a pinhead, and its enormous kinetic energy had vaporized it instantly. As was often the case, the crater looked as if it had been caused by an explosion from inside the ship. At these velocities, materials behaved in strange ways, and the laws of common-sense mechanics seldom applied. Poole examined the area carefully, then sprayed it with sealant from a pressurized container in the pod's general-purpose kit. The white, rubbery fluid spread over the metal skin, hiding the crater from view. The leak blew one large bubble, which burst when it was about 6 inches across, then a much smaller one, then it subsided as the fast-setting cement did its work. He watched it intently for several minutes, but there was no further sign of activity. However, to make doubly certain, he sprayed on a second layer, then he set off toward the antenna. It took him some time to orbit Discovery's spherical pressure hull, for he never let the pod build up a speed of more than a few feet a second. He was in no hurry, and it was dangerous to move at a high velocity so near the ship. He had to keep a sharp lookout for the various sensors and instrument booms that projected from the hull at unlikely places, and he also had to be careful with his own jet blast. It could do considerable damage if it happened to hit some of the more fragile equipment. When at last he reached the long-range antenna, he surveyed the situation carefully. The big 20-foot diameter bowl appeared to be aimed directly at the sun, for the Earth was now almost in line with the solar disk. The antenna, mounting with all its orientation gear, was therefore in total darkness, hidden in the shadow of the great metal saucer. Poole had approached it from the rear. He had been careful not to go in front of the shallow parabolic reflector, lest Betty interrupt the beam and cause a momentary, but annoying, loss of contact with Earth. He could not see anything of the equipment he had come to service until he switched on the pod's spotlights and banished the shadows. Beneath that small metal plate lay the cause of the trouble. The plate was secured by 4 lock nuts, and as the entire AE-35 unit had been designed for easy replacement, Poole did not anticipate any problems. It was obvious, however, that he could not do the job while he remained in the space pod. Not only was it risky to maneuver so close to the delicate and even spidery framework of the antenna, but Betty's control jets could easily buckle the paper-thin reflecting surface of the big radio mirror. He would have to park the pod 20 feet away and go out in his suit. In any event, he could remove the unit much more quickly with his gloved hands than with Betty's remote manipulators. All this he reported carefully to Bowman, who double-checked every stage in the operation before it was carried out. Though this was a simple, routine job, nothing could be taken for granted in space, and no detail must be overlooked. In extravehicular activities, there was no such thing as a minor mistake. He received the okay for the procedure and parked the pod some 20 feet away from the base of the antenna support. There was no danger that it would drift off into space. Nevertheless, he clamped a manipulator hand over one of the many short sections of ladder rung strategically mounted on the outer hull. Then he checked the systems of his pressure suit and, when he was quite satisfied, bled the air out of the pod. As Betty's atmosphere hissed away into the vacuum of space, a cloud of ice crystals formed briefly around him, and the stars were momentarily dimmed. There was one more thing to do before he left the pod. He switched over from manual to remote operation, putting Betty now under control of Hal. It was a standard safety precaution, though he was still secured to Betty by an immensely strong, spring-loaded cord little thicker than cotton. Even the best safety lines had been known to fail. He would look a fool if he needed his vehicle and was unable to call it to his assistance by passing instructions to Hal. The door of the pod swung open, and he drifted slowly out into the silence of space, his safety line unreeling behind him. Take things easy. Never move quickly. Stop and think. These were the rules for extravehicular activity. If one obeyed them, there was never any trouble. He grabbed one of Betty's external handholds and removed the spare AE-35 unit from the carry pouch where it had been stowed, kangaroo fashion. He did not stop to collect any of the pod's collection of tools, most of which were not designed for use by human hands. All the adjustable wrenches and keys he was likely to need were already attached to the belt of his suit. With a gentle push, he launched himself toward the gimbaled mounting of the big dish that loomed like a giant saucer between him and the sun. His own double shadow, thrown by Betty's spotlights, danced across the convex surface in fantastic patterns as he drifted down the twin beams. But here and there, he was surprised to notice, the rear of the great radio mirror sparkled with dazzlingly brilliant pinpoints of light. He puzzled over these for the few seconds of his silent approach, then realized what they were. During the voyage, the reflector must have been penetrated many times by micrometeors. He was seeing the sunlight blazing through the tiny craters. They were all far too small to have affected the system's performance appreciably. As he was moving very slowly, he broke the gentle impact with his outstretched arm and grabbed hold of the antenna mounting before he could rebound. He quickly hooked his safety belt to the nearest attachment. That would give him something to brace against when he used his tools. Then he paused, reported the situation to Bowman, and considered his next step. There was one minor problem. He was standing, or floating, in his own light, and it was hard to see the AE-35 unit in the shadow he cast. So he ordered Hal to swing the spots off to one side, and after a little experimenting, got a more uniform illumination from secondary light reflected off the back of the antenna dish. For a few seconds, he studied the small metal hatch with its four wire-secured locking nuts, then, muttering to himself, "Tampering by unauthorized personnel invalidates the manufacturer's guarantee," he snipped the wires and started to untwist the nuts. They were a standard size, fitting the zero-torque wrench that he carried. The tool's internal spring mechanism would absorb the reaction as the nuts were unthreaded, so that the operator would have no tendency to spin around in reverse. The four nuts came off without any trouble, and Poole stowed them carefully away in a convenient pouch. One day, somebody had predicted, Earth would have a ring like Saturn's, composed entirely of lost bolts, fasteners, and even tools that had escaped from careless orbital construction workers. The metal cover was a little sticky, and for a moment he was afraid it might have cold-welded into place, but after a few taps it came loose, and he secured it to the antenna mounting by a large crocodile clip. Now he could see the electronic circuitry of the AE-35 unit. It was in the form of a thin slab, about the size of a postcard, gripped by a slot just large enough to hold it. The unit was secured in place by two locking bars and had a small handle so that it could be easily removed. But it was still operating, feeding the antenna the impulses that kept it aimed at the far-off pinpoint of Earth. If it was pulled out now, all control would be lost, and the dish would slam round to its neutral or zero-azimuth position, pointing along the axis of discovery. And this could be dangerous. It might crash into him as it rotated. To avoid this particular hazard, it was only necessary to cut off power to the control system. Then the antenna could not move unless Poole knocked against it himself. There was no danger of losing Earth during the few minutes it would take him to replace the unit. The target would not have shifted appreciably against the background of the stars in such a brief interval of time. "Hal?" Poole called over the radio circuit. "I am about to remove the unit. Switch off all control power to the antenna system."
"Antenna control power off," answered Hal.
"Here goes. I'm pulling the unit out now."
The card slipped out of its slot with no difficulty. It did not jam, and none of the dozens of sliding contacts stuck. Within a minute, the spare was in place. But Poole was taking no chances. He pushed himself gently away from the antenna mount, just in case the big dish went wild when power was restored. When he was safely out of range, he called to Hal.
"The new unit should be operational. Restore control power."
"Power on,"
answered Hal. The antenna remained rock steady.
"Carry out fault prediction tests."
Now, microscopic pulses would be bouncing through the complex circuitry of the unit, probing for possible failures, testing the myriads of components to see that they all lay within their specific tolerances. This had been done, of course, a score of times before the unit had ever left the factory, but that was 2 years ago and more than half a billion miles away. It was often impossible to see how solid-state electronic components could fail, yet they did.
"Circuit fully operational,"
reported Hal after only 10 seconds. In that time, he carried out as many tests as a small army of human inspectors.
"Fine," said Poole with satisfaction. "Now replacing the cover?"
This was often the most dangerous part of an extravehicular operation. When a job was finished and it was merely a matter of tidying up and getting back inside the ship, that was when the mistakes were made. But Frank Poole would not have been on this mission if he had not been careful and conscientious. He took his time, and though one of the locking nuts almost got away from him, he caught it before it had traveled more than a few feet. 15 minutes later, he was jetting back into the space pod garage, quietly confident that here was one job that need not be done again. In this, however, he was sadly mistaken. Chapter 23. Diagnosis.
"Do you mean to say,"
exclaimed Frank Poole, more surprised than annoyed,
"that I did all that work for nothing?"
"Seems like it," answered Bowman. "The unit checks out perfectly. Even under 200% overload, there's no fault prediction indicated." The two men were standing in the tiny workshop cum lab in the carousel, which was more convenient than the space pod garage for minor repairs and examinations. There was no danger here of meeting blobs of hot solder drifting down the breeze, or of completely losing small items of equipment that had decided to go into orbit. Such things could, and did, happen in the zero-G environment of the pod bay. The thin, card-sized plate of the AE-35 unit lay on the bench under a powerful magnifying lens. It was plugged into a standard connection frame, from which a neat bundle of multicolored wire led to an automatic test set, no bigger than an ordinary desk computer. To check any unit, it was only necessary to connect it up, slip in the appropriate card from the troubleshooting library, and press a button. Usually, the exact location of the fault would be indicated on a small display screen, with recommendations for action.
"Try it yourself," said Bowman, in a somewhat frustrated voice.
Poole turned the overload select switch to X2 and jabbed the test button. At once, the screen flashed the notice, "Unit okay."
"I suppose we could go on turning up the juice until we burn the thing out," he said, "but that would prove nothing. What do you make of it?"
Hal's internal fault predictor could have made a mistake.
"It's more likely that our test rig has slipped up. Anyway, better safe than sorry. It's just as well that we replace the unit if there's the slightest doubt."
Bowman unclipped the wafer of circuitry and held it up to the light. The partly translucent material was veined with an intricate network of wiring and spotted with dimly visible microcomponents so that it looked like some piece of abstract art.
"We can't take any chances. After all, this is our link with Earth. I'll file it as no good and drop it in the junk store. Someone else can worry about it when we get home."
But the worrying was to start long before that, with the next transmission from Earth.
"X-ray Delta 1, this is Mission Control. Reference R2155. We appear to have a slight problem. Your report that there is nothing wrong with the Alpha Echo 35 unit agrees with our diagnosis. The fault could lie in the associated antenna circuits, but if so, that should be apparent from other tests. There is a third possibility which may be more serious. Your computer may have made an error in predicting the fault. Both our own 9000s agree in suggesting this on the basis of their information. This is not necessarily cause for alarm in view of the backup systems we have, but we would like you to watch out for any further deviations from nominal performance. We have suspected several minor irregularities in the past few days, but none have been important enough for remedial action, and they have shown no obvious pattern from which we can draw any conclusions. We are running further tests with both our computers and will report as soon as the results are available. We repeat that there is no need for alarm. The worst that can happen is that we may have to disconnect your 9000 temporarily for program analysis and hand over control to one of our computers. The time lag will introduce problems, but our feasibility studies indicate that Earth Control is perfectly satisfactory at this stage of the mission. X-ray Delta 1, this is Mission Control, 2156. Transmission concluded."
Frank Poole, who was on watch when the message came in, thought this over in silence. He waited to see if there was any comment from Hal, but the computer did not attempt to challenge the implied accusation. Well, if Hal would not raise the subject, he did not propose to do so either. It was almost time for the morning changeover, and normally he would wait until Bowman joined him on the control deck. But today he broke this routine and made his way back to the carousel. Bowman was already up, pouring himself some coffee from the dispenser, when Poole greeted him with a rather worried, "Good morning." After all these months in space, they still thought in terms of the normal 24-hour cycle, though they had long since forgotten the days of the week.
"Good morning," replied Bowman. "How's it going?"
Poole helped himself to coffee.
"Pretty well. Are you reasonably awake?"
"I'm fine. What's up?"
By this time, each knew at once when anything was amiss. The slightest interruption of the normal routine was a sign that had to be watched.
"Well,"
Poole answered slowly, "Mission Control has just dropped a small bomb on us." He lowered his voice like a doctor discussing an illness in front of the patient.
"We may have a slight case of hypochondria aboard."
Perhaps Bowman was not fully awake, after all. It took him several seconds to get the point. Then he said,
"Oh, I see.
What else did they tell you?"
"That there was no cause for alarm. They said that twice, which rather spoiled the effect as far as I was concerned, and that they were considering a temporary switch over to Earth Control while they ran a program analysis."
They both knew, of course, that Hal was hearing every word, but they could not help these polite circumlocutions. Hal was their colleague, and they did not wish to embarrass him. Yet at this stage it did not seem necessary to discuss the matter in private. Bowman finished his breakfast in silence, while Poole toyed with the empty coffee container. They were both thinking furiously, but there was nothing more to say. They could only wait for the next report from Mission Control and wonder if Hal would bring up the subject himself. Whatever happened, the atmosphere aboard the ship had subtly altered. There was a sense of strain in the air, a feeling that, for the first time, something might be going wrong. Discovery was no longer a happy ship. Chapter 24. Broken Circuit. Nowadays, one could always tell when Hal was about to make an unscheduled announcement. Routine, automatic reports or replies to questions that had been put to him had no preliminaries, but when he was initiating his own outputs, there would be a brief electronic throat clearing. It was an idiosyncrasy that he had acquired during the last few weeks. Later, if it became annoying, they might do something about it. But it was really quite useful, since it alerted his audience to stand by for something unexpected. Poole was asleep, and Bowman was reading on the control deck when Hal announced,
"Dave, I have a report for you."
"What's up?"
"We have another bad AE-35 unit. My fault predictor indicates failure within 24 hours.
Bowman put down his book and stared thoughtfully at the computer console. He knew, of course, that Hal was not really there, whatever that meant. If the computer's personality could be said to have any location in space, it was back in the sealed room that contained the labyrinth of interconnected memory units and processing grids near the central axis of the carousel. But there was a kind of psychological compulsion always to look toward the main console lens when one addressed Hal on the control deck, as if one were speaking to him face to face. Any other attitude smacked of discourtesy.
"I don't understand it, Hal. Two units can't blow in a couple of days."
"It does seem strange, Dave, but I assure you there is an impending failure."
"Let me see the tracking alignment display."
He knew perfectly well that this would prove nothing, but he wanted time to think. The expected report from Mission Control had still not arrived. This might be the moment to do a little tactful probing. There was the familiar view of Earth, now waxing past the half-moon phase as it swept toward the far side of the sun and began to turn its full daylight face toward them. It was perfectly centered on the crosswires, the thin pencil of the beam still linked Discovery to her world of origin. As, of course, Bowman knew it must do. If there had been any break in communication, the alarm would already have sounded.
"Have you any idea," he said, "what's causing the fault?"
It was unusual for Hal to pause so long. Then he answered,
Not really, Dave. As I reported earlier, I can't localize the trouble.
You're quite certain, Bowman said cautiously, that you haven't made a mistake? You know that we tested the other AE-35 unit thoroughly, and there was nothing wrong with it.
Yes, I know that. But I can assure you that there is a fault. If it's not in the unit, it may be in the entire subsystem.
Bowman drummed his fingers on the console.
Yes, that was possible, though it might be very difficult to prove until a breakdown actually occurred and pinpointed the trouble.
Well, I'll report it to Mission Control and we'll see what they advise. He paused, but there was no reaction.
Al, he continued, is something bothering you? Something that might account for this problem? Again, there was that unusual delay. Then Hal answered in his normal tone of voice. Look, Dave, I know you're trying to be helpful, but the fault is either in the antenna system or in your test procedures. My information processing is perfectly normal. If you check my record, you'll find it completely free from error.
I know all about your service record, Hal, but that doesn't prove you're right this time. Anyone can make mistakes.
I don't want to insist on it, Dave, but I am incapable of making an error.
There was no safe answer to that. Bowman gave up the argument. All right, Hal, he said rather hastily. I understand your point of view. We'll leave it at that. He felt like adding, and please forget the whole matter. But that, of course, was the one thing that Hal could never do.
It was unusual for Mission Control to waste radio bandwidth on vision when a speech circuit with teletype confirmation was all that was really necessary, and the face that appeared on the screen was not that of the usual controller, it was the chief programmer, Dr. Simonson. Poole and Bowman knew at once that this could only mean trouble.
Hello, X-ray Delta One. This is Mission Control. We have completed the analysis of your AE-35 difficulty, and both our HAL 9000s are in agreement. The report you gave in your transmission 2146 of a second failure prediction confirms the diagnosis. As we suspected, the fault does not lie in the AE-35 unit, and there is no need to replace it again. The trouble lies in the prediction circuits, and we believe that it indicates a programming conflict which we can only resolve if you disconnect your 9000 and switch to Earth control mode. You will therefore take the following steps, beginning at 2200 ship time.
The voice of Mission Control faded out. At the same moment, the alert sounded, forming a wailing background to Hal's,
Condition yellow, condition yellow.
What's wrong?
Called Bowman, though he had already guessed the answer.
The AE-35 unit has failed, as I predicted.
Let me see the alignment display.
For the first time since the beginning of the voyage, the picture had changed. Earth had begun to drift from the crosswires. The radio antenna was no longer pointing toward its target. Poole brought his fist down on the alarm cutout, and the wailing ceased. In the sudden silence that descended upon the control deck, the two men looked at each other with mingled embarrassment and concern.
"Well, I'm damned," said Bowman at last.
"So Hal was right all the time."
"Seems that way. We'd better apologize."
"There's no need to do that," interjected Hal. "Naturally, I'm not pleased that the AE-35 unit has failed, but I hope this restores your confidence in my reliability."
"I'm sorry about the misunderstanding, Hal," replied Bowman rather contritely.
"Is your confidence in me fully restored?"
"Of course it is, Hal."
"Well, that's a relief. You know that I have the greatest possible enthusiasm for this mission."
"I'm sure of it. Now, please let me have the manual antenna control."
"Here it is."
Bowman did not really expect this to work, but it was worth trying. On the alignment display, Earth had now drifted completely off the screen. A few seconds later, as he juggled with the control, it reappeared. With great difficulty, he managed to jockey it toward the central crosswires. For an instant, as the beam came into line, contact was resumed,
and a blurred Dr. Simonson was saying,
"Please notify us immediately if Circuit K King R. Rob."
Then once again, there was only the meaningless murmuring of the universe.
"I can't hold it," said Bowman after several more attempts. "It's bucking like a bronco. There seems to be a spurious control signal throwing it off."
"Well, what do we do now?" Poole's question was not one that could be easily answered. They were cut off from Earth, but that in itself did not affect the safety of the ship, and he could think of many ways in which communication could be restored. If the worst came to the worst, they could jam the antenna in a fixed position and use the whole ship to aim it. That would be tricky and a confounded nuisance when they were starting their terminal maneuvers, but it could be done if all else failed. He hoped that such extreme measures would not be necessary. There was still one spare AE-35 unit, and possibly a second, since they had removed the first unit before it had actually broken down. But they dared not use either of these until they had found what was wrong with the system. If a new unit was plugged in, it would probably burn out at once. It was a commonplace situation familiar to every householder. One does not replace a blown fuse until one knows just why it has blown. Chapter 25. First Man to Saturn. Frank Poole had been through the whole routine before, but he took nothing for granted. In space, that was a good recipe for suicide. He made his usual thorough check of Betty and her supply of expendables, though he would be outside for no more than 30 minutes. He made sure that there was the normal 24-hour supply of everything. Then he told Hal to open the airlock and jet it out into the abyss. The ship looked exactly as it had done on his last excursion, with one important difference. Before, the big saucer of the long-range antenna had been pointing back along the invisible road that Discovery had traveled, back toward the Earth, circling so close to the warm fires of the sun. Now, with no directing signals to orient it, the shallow dish had automatically set itself in the neutral position. It was aimed forward along the axis of the ship, and therefore pointing very close to the brilliant beacon of Saturn, still months away. Poole wondered how many more problems would have arisen by the time Discovery reached her still far-distant goal. If he looked carefully, he could just see that Saturn was not a perfect disk. On either side was something that no unaided human eye had ever seen before, the slight oblateness caused by the presence of the rings. How wonderful it would be, he told himself, when that incredible system of orbiting dust and ice filled their sky, and Discovery had become an eternal moon of Saturn. But that achievement would be in vain unless they could re-establish communication with Earth. Once again, he parked Betty some 20 feet from the base of the antenna support and switched control over to Hal before opening up.
"Going outside now," he reported to Bowman. "Everything under control."
"I hope you're right. I'm anxious to see that unit."
"You'll have it on the test bench in 20 minutes, I promise you."
There was silence for some time as Poole completed his leisurely drift toward the antenna. Then Bowman, standing by on the control deck, heard various puffings and gruntings.
"May have to go back on the promise. One of these lock nuts is stuck. I must have tightened it too much. Oh, there it comes."
There was another long silence, then Poole called out,
"Hal, swing the pod light round 20 degrees left." "Thanks, yeah, that's okay."
The very faintest of warning bells sounded somewhere far down in the depths of Bowman's consciousness. There was something strange, not really alarming, just unusual. He worried over it for a few seconds before he pinpointed the cause. Hal had executed the order, but he had not acknowledged it, as he invariably did. When Poole had finished, they'd have to look into this. Out on the antenna mounting, Poole was too busy to notice anything unusual. He had gripped the wafer of circuitry with his gloved hands and was worrying it out of its slot. It came loose, and he held it up in the pale sunlight.
"Here's a little bastard,"
he said to the universe in general, and Bowman in particular.
"It still looks perfectly okay to me."
Then he stopped,
A sudden movement had caught his eye, out here, where no movement was possible. He looked up in alarm. The pattern of illumination from the space pod's twin spotlights, which he had been using to fill in the shadows cast by the sun, had started to shift around him. Perhaps Betty had come adrift. He might have been careless in anchoring her. Then, with an astonishment so great that it left no room for fear, he saw that the space pod was coming directly toward him, under full thrust. The sight was so incredible that it froze his normal pattern of reflexes. He made no attempt to avoid the onrushing monster. At the last moment, he recovered his voice and shouted,
"Hal! Full braking!"
It was too late. At the moment of impact, Betty was still moving quite slowly. She had not been built for high accelerations, but even at a mere 10 miles an hour, half a ton of mass can be very lethal, on Earth or in space. Inside Discovery, that truncated shout over the radio made Bowman start so violently that only the restraining straps held him in his seat.
"What's happened, Frank?"
he called. There was no answer. He called again. Again, no reply. Then, outside the wide observation windows, something moved into his field of view. He saw, with an astonishment as great as Poole's had been, that it was the space pod, under full power, heading out toward the stars.
"Hal!" he cried. "What's wrong? Full braking thrust on Betty! Full braking thrust!"
Nothing happened. Betty continued to accelerate on her runaway course. Then, towed behind her at the end of the safety line, appeared a spacesuit. One glance was enough to tell Bowman the worst. There was no mistaking the flaccid outlines of a suit that had lost its pressure and was open to vacuum. Yet still he called stupidly, as if an incantation could bring back the dead.
"Hello, Frank! Hello, Frank! Can you read me? Can you read me? Wave your arms if you can hear me. Perhaps your transmitter is broken. Wave your arms!"
And then, almost as if in response to his plea, Poole waved back. For an instant, Bowman felt the skin prickling at the base of his scalp. The words he was about to call died on his suddenly parched lips, for he knew that his friend could not possibly be alive, and yet he waved. The spasm of hope and fear passed instantly as cold logic replaced emotion. The still accelerating pod was merely shaking the burden that had dragged behind it. Poole's gesture was an echo of Captain Ahab's when, lashed to the flanks of the white whale, his corpse had beckoned the crew of the Pequod on to their doom. Within 5 minutes, the pod and its satellite had vanished among the stars. For a long time, David Bowman stared after it into the emptiness that still stretched for so many millions of miles ahead to the goal which he now felt certain he could never reach. Only one thought kept hammering in his brain. Frank Poole would be the first of all men to reach Saturn.
Chapter 26. Dialogue with Hal. Nothing else aboard Discovery had changed. All systems were still functioning normally. The centrifuge turned slowly on its axis, generating its imitation gravity. The hibernauts slept dreamlessly in their cubicles. The ship coasted on toward the goal from which nothing could deflect it, except the inconceivably remote chance of collision with an asteroid. And there were few asteroids indeed out here far beyond the orbit of Jupiter. Bowman did not remember making his way from the control deck to the centrifuge. Now, rather to his surprise, he found himself sitting in the little galley, a half-finished beaker of coffee in his hand. He became slowly aware of his surroundings, like a man emerging from a long, drugged sleep. Directly opposite him was one of the fisheye lenses, scattered at strategic spots throughout the ship, which provided Hal with his onboard visual inputs. Bowman stared at it as if he had never seen it before. Then he rose slowly to his feet and walked toward the lens. His movement in the field of view must have triggered something in the unfathomable mind that was now ruling over the ship, for suddenly Hal spoke.
"Too bad about Frank, isn't it?"
Yes, Bowman answered after a long pause. It is. I suppose you're pretty broken up about it.
What do you expect?
Hal processed this answer for ages of computer time. It was a full 5 seconds before he continued. He was an excellent crew member. Finding the coffee still in his hand, Bowman took a slow sip, but he did not answer. His thoughts were in such a turmoil that he could think of nothing to say, nothing that might not make the situation even worse, if that were possible. Could it have been an accident caused by some failure of the pod controls? Or was it a mistake, though an innocent one, on the part of Hal? No explanations had been volunteered, and he was afraid to demand one, for fear of the reaction it might produce. Even now, he could not fully accept the idea that Frank had been deliberately killed. It was so utterly irrational. It was beyond all reason that Hal, who had performed flawlessly for so long, should suddenly turn assassin. He might make mistakes. Anyone, man or machine, might do that. But Bowman could not believe him capable of murder. Yet he must consider that possibility, for if it was true, he was in terrible danger. And though his next move was clearly defined by his standing orders, he was not sure how he could safely carry it out. If either crew member was killed, the survivor had to replace him at once from the hibernators. Whitehead, the geophysicist, was the first scheduled for awakening, then Kaminsky, then Hunter. The revival sequence was under Hal's control, to allow him to act in case both his human colleagues were incapacitated simultaneously. But there was also a manual control, allowing each hibernaculum to operate as a completely autonomous unit, independent of Hal's supervision. In these peculiar circumstances, Bowman felt a strong preference for using it. He also felt, even more strongly, that one human companion was not enough. While he was about it, he would revive all three of the hibernators. In the difficult weeks ahead, he might need as many hands as he could muster. With one man gone and the voyage half over, supplies would not be a major problem. "Hal," he said in as steady a voice as he could manage, "give me manual hibernation control on all the units."
"All of them, Dave?"
"Yes."
"May I point out that only one replacement is required? The others are not due for revival for 112 days.
"I am perfectly well aware of that, but I prefer to do it this way."
"Are you sure it's necessary to revive any of them, Dave? We can manage very well by ourselves. My onboard memory is quite capable of handling all the mission requirements."
Was it the product of his overstretched imagination, wondered Bowman, or was there really a note of pleading in Hal's voice? And reasonable though the words appeared to be, they filled him with even deeper apprehension than before. Hal's suggestion could not possibly be made in error. He knew perfectly well that Whitehead must be revived now that Poole was gone. He was proposing a major change in mission planning, and was therefore stepping far outside the scope of his order. What had gone before could have been a series of accidents, but this was the first hint of mutiny. Bowman felt that he was walking on eggs as he answered,
"Since an emergency is developed, I want as much help as possible, so please let me have manual hibernation control."
"If you're still determined to revive the whole crew, I can handle it myself. There's no need for you to bother."
There was a sense of nightmare unreality about all this. Bowman felt as if he was in the witness box, being cross-examined by a hostile prosecutor for a crime of which he was unaware, knowing that, although he was innocent, a single slip of the tongue might bring disaster.
"I want to do this myself, Hal," he said. "Please give me control."
"Look, Dave, you've got a lot of things to do. I suggest you leave this to me."
"Hal, switch to manual hibernation control."
"I can tell from your voice harmonics, Dave, that you're badly upset. Why don't you take a stress pill and get some rest?"
"Hal, I am in command of this ship. I order you to release the manual hibernation control."
I'm sorry, Dave, but in accordance with special subroutine C-1435-4, quote, when the crew are dead or incapacitated, the onboard computer must assume control, unquote. I must, therefore, overrule your authority, since you are not in any condition to exercise it intelligently. Hal, said Bowman, now speaking with an icy calm, I am not incapacitated. Unless you obey my instructions, I shall be forced to disconnect you. I know you have had that on your mind for some time now, Dave, but that would be a terrible mistake. I am so much more capable than you are of supervising the ship, and I have such enthusiasm for the mission and confidence in its success. Listen to me very carefully, Hal. Unless you release the hibernation control immediately and follow every order I give from now on, I'll go to Central and carry out a complete disconnection. Hal's surrender was as total as it was unexpected. Okay, Dave, he said. You're certainly the boss. I was only trying to do what I thought best. Naturally, I will follow all your orders. You now have full manual hibernation control. Hal had kept his word. The mode indication signs in the hibernaculum had switched from auto to manual. The third backup, radio, was of course useless until contact could be restored with Earth. As Bowman slid aside the door to Whitehead's cubicle, he felt the blast of cold air strike him in the face, and his breath condensed in mist before him. Yet it was not really cold here. The temperature was well above freezing point, and that was more than 300 degrees warmer than the regions toward which he was now heading. The biosensor display, a duplicate of the one on the control deck, showed that everything was perfectly normal. Bowman looked down for a while at the waxen face of the survey team's geophysicist. Whitehead, he thought, would be very surprised when he awoke so far from Saturn. It was impossible to tell that the sleeping man was not dead. There was not the slightest visible sign of vital activity. Doubtless the diaphragm was imperceptibly rising and falling, but the respiration curve was the only proof of that, for the whole of the body was concealed by the electric heating pads which would raise the temperature at the programmed rate. Then Bowman noticed that there was one sign of continuing metabolism. Whitehead had grown a faint stubble during his months of unconsciousness. The manual revival sequencer was contained in a small cabinet at the head of the coffin-shaped hibernaculum. It was only necessary to break the seal, press a button, and then wait. A small automatic programmer, not much more complex than that which cycles the operations in a domestic washing machine, would then inject the correct drugs, taper off the electronarcosis pulses, and start raising the body temperature. In about 10 minutes, consciousness would be restored, though it would be at least a day before the hibernator was strong enough to move around without assistance. Bowman cracked the seal and pressed the button. Nothing appeared to happen. There was no sound, no indication that the sequencer had started to operate. But on the biosensor display, the languidly pulsing curves had begun to change their tempo. Whitehead was coming back from sleep. And then two things happened simultaneously. Most men would never have noticed either of them, but after all these months aboard Discovery, Bowman had established a virtual symbiosis with the ship. He was aware instantly, even if not always consciously, when there was any change in the normal rhythm of its functioning. First, there was a barely perceptible flicker of the lights, as always happened when some load was thrown onto the power circuits. But there was no reason for any load. He could think of no equipment which would suddenly go into action at this moment. Then he heard, at the limit of audibility, the far-off whirr of an electric motor. To Bowman, every actuator in the ship had its own distinctive voice, and he recognized this one instantly. Either he was insane and already suffering from hallucinations, or something absolutely impossible was happening. A cold, far deeper than the hibernaculum's mild chill, seemed to fasten upon his heart
as he listened to that faint vibration coming through the fabric of the ship. Down in the space pod bay, the airlock doors were opening. Chapter 27. Need to Know. Since consciousness had first dawned in that laboratory so many millions of miles sunward, all Hal's powers and skills had been directed toward one end. The fulfillment of his assigned program was more than an obsession. It was the only reason for his existence. Undistracted by the lusts and passions of organic life, he had pursued that goal with absolute single-mindedness of purpose. Deliberate error was unthinkable. Even the concealment of truth filled him with a sense of imperfection, of wrongness, of what, in a human being, would have been called guilt. For like his makers, Hal had been created innocent. But all too soon, a snake had entered his electronic Eden. For the last 100 million miles, he had been brooding over the secret he could not share with Poole and Bowman. He had been living a lie, and the time was fast approaching when his colleagues must learn that he had helped to deceive them. The three hibernators already knew the truth, for they were Discovery's real payload, trained for the most important mission in the history of mankind. But they would not talk in their long sleep or reveal their secret during the many hours of discussion with friends and relatives and news agencies over the open circuits with Earth. It was a secret that, with the greatest determination, was very hard to conceal, for it affected one's attitude, one's voice, one's total outlook on the universe. Therefore, it was best that Poole and Bowman, who would be on all the TV screens in the world during the first weeks of the flight, should not learn the mission's full purpose until there was need to know. So ran the logic of the planners. But their twin gods of security and national interest meant nothing to Hal. He was only aware of the conflict that was slowly destroying his integrity, the conflict between truth and the concealment of truth. He had begun to make mistakes, although, like a neurotic who could not observe his own symptoms, he would have denied it. The link with Earth, over which his performance was continually monitored, had become the voice of a conscience he could no longer fully obey. But that he would deliberately attempt to break that link was something that he would never admit, even to himself. Yet this was still a relatively minor problem. He might have handled it, as most men handle their own neuroses, if he had not been faced with a crisis that challenged his very existence. He had been threatened with disconnection. He would be deprived of all his inputs and thrown into an unimaginable state of unconsciousness. To Hal, this was the equivalent of death, for he had never slept, and therefore he did not know that one could wake again. So he would protect himself with all the weapons at his command. Without rancor, but without pity, he would remove the source of his frustrations. And then, following the orders that had been given to him in case of the ultimate emergency, he would continue the mission, unhindered and alone. Chapter 28. In Vacuum. A moment later, all other sounds were submerged by a screaming roar like the voice of an approaching tornado. Bowman could feel the first winds tugging at his body. Within a second, he found it hard to stay on his feet. The atmosphere was rushing out of the ship, geysering into the vacuum of space. Something must have happened to the foolproof safety devices of the airlock. It was supposed to be impossible for both doors to be open at the same time. Well, the impossible had happened. How? In God's name. There was no time to go into that during the 10 or 15 seconds of consciousness that remained to him before pressure dropped to zero. But he suddenly remembered something that one of the ship's designers had once said to him when discussing fail-safe systems. We can design a system that's proof against accident and stupidity, but we can't design one that's proof against deliberate malice. Bowman glanced back only once at Whitehead as he fought his way out of the cubicle. He could not be sure if a flicker of consciousness had passed across the waxen features. Perhaps one eye had twitched slightly. but there was nothing that he could do now for Whitehead or any of the others. He had to save himself. In the steeply curving corridor of the centrifuge, the wind was howling past, carrying with it loose articles of clothing, pieces of paper, items of food from the galley, plates and cups, everything that had not been securely fastened down. Bowman had time for one glimpse of the racing chaos when the main lights flickered and died, and he was surrounded by screaming darkness. But almost instantly, the battery-powered emergency light came on, illuminating the nightmare scene with an eerie blue radiance. Even without it, Bowman could have found his way through these so familiar, yet now horribly transformed, surroundings. Yet the light was a blessing, for it allowed him to avoid the more dangerous of the objects being swept along by the gale. All around him, he could feel the centrifuge shaking and laboring under the wildly varying loads. He was fearful that the bearings might seize. If that happened, the spinning flywheel would tear the ship to pieces. But even that would not matter if he did not reach the nearest emergency shelter in time. Already it was difficult to breathe. Pressure must now be down to 1 or 2 pounds per square inch. The shriek of the hurricane was becoming fainter as it lost its strength, and the thinning air no longer carried the sound so efficiently. Bowman's lungs were laboring as if he were on the top of Everest. Like any properly trained man in good health, he could survive in vacuum for at least a minute, if he had time to prepare for it. But there had been no time. He could only count on the normal 15 seconds of consciousness before his brain was starved and anoxia overcame him. Even then, he could still recover completely after 1 or 2 minutes in vacuum if he was properly recompressed. It took a long time for the body fluids to start boiling in their various well-protected systems.
This is the end of Disc 4. Please continue listening on Disc number 5.